thanks to the organisers for inviting me, and congratulations to them on this incredible feat of bringing this conference together across all these locations. It's quite remarkable. And thank you to the people who are in the room, and I'm really looking forward to the discussion that follows my presentation. I'm going to speak for about 35 minutes and then we'll open it up for a discussion. So rich private schools, particularly rich private schools for boys, have had a lot of bad publicity lately. This has been associated with two main events. The first is related to the work of Chanel Kontos. She is a private school girl from Sydney, and she's currently a student at University College London doing a master's on gender and education and international development. Now, her work began with an Instagram poll asking, have you or has anyone close to you ever been sexually assaulted by someone who went to an all-boys school in Sydney? In 24 hours, 200 people said yes. Over the same period of time, only 50 replied yes to this question. If you went to an all-boys school in Sydney, do you think any of your friends has ever sexually assaulted someone? So that's 50 compared to 200. She followed this up with a school sexual assault petition calling for schools to offer better sexual consent education. She also gave signatories of the petition the chance to upload a testimony. And she got over 30,000 signatures and almost 5,000 testimonies. A common theme running through the testimonies is that the girls were raped while unconscious or forced to perform oral sex while they were severely intoxicated. Others said they were pressured to perform non-consensual sexual acts, including threesomes. They were forced to drink a lot more than appropriate alcohol, and they woke up to being touched by somebody in an inappropriate way. Originally, she uncovered how normalised and widespread sexual assault is by boys coming from boys' expensive schools. The subsequent petition got responses from all over Australia and from a wide range of schools, including government schools. But it certainly got a lot of responses from boys' expensive schools in all the different states. So that's the first event that's bad publicity for these schools. The second event relates to Christian Porter's historical rape allegation by a woman who became known as Kate. The alleged rape occurred after a university debating society event at a Sydney uni dormitory in 1988. I think it was 88 or maybe 87, I'm not sure, 88. Kate was 16 and still at school. Porter was 17. Now, the widely aired allegations led to a focus on Porter's biography. When at Hale School and at UWA, it also led to a focus on his pedigree, which is very, very full on, and his membership of university debating societies. Now, for those of you who don't know, university debating circles are dominated by ex-private school students. Their members often go on to careers in law and politics. And there's a good article in Crikey, actually, on this topic, if you wanted to check that out. Now, what emerged from this inquiry into his background was his odious behaviour while he was in UWA Law School. This was well documented on the Four Corners program Inside the Canberra Bubble that went to air in 2020. And it's been well documented by other sources since. Now, there's some common threads running through these two events, and I just want to name them. The first common thread is related to the misogyny of privileged boys in rich private schools, to the fact that many men in Parliament went to such schools, and to the obvious fact that their misogyny travels with them over their life course. The second thread links their misogyny to a wide range of highly problematic identities, behaviours, cultures and systems. For example, with regard to identities, toxic masculinity, male entitlement. Behaviours, gaslighting, slut-shaming, sexual harassment, sexual abuse and rape. Cultures, toxic culture, rape culture. Systems, patriarchal. Clearly, we have a well-established and compelling linguistic repertoire to describe these problems. And in contrast, the language now commonly mobilised to challenge these problems seems very mild. And the two words that are commonly around, I'm sure you're aware, are consent and respect. My response to that is really, is that all there is? And we can talk about that further in the discussion later if you would like to. Now, these two events dovetailed into wider considerations. These include what I call the rich boys' misogyny pipeline. And this is how it works. Private school boys go from elite schools to elite universities and elite university colleges where misogyny thrives. While at uni, they join certain clubs, sporting, societies, debating, and political organisations, the Young Liberals. These consolidate the values that they learnt at school and deepen and extend the networks that began at school. So misogyny deepens and misogyny spreads. From university, they move smoothly through to various positions of power and privilege in politics, the professions, business and industry, and sport. In these positions, they are surrounded by clones of themselves and they appoint clones of themselves. Misogyny is institutionalized and spreads yet further. They usually partner up with people of the same school backgrounds, those who subscribe to the values that are similar to their own. When they have boy children, misogyny is reproduced across the generations. Repeat the process. A second consideration, and this is one I find really interesting and intriguing, and I'm sort of currently in trying to interpret this, is the gender wars within the privileged classes. As a student of these schools, I want to interpret them and I'm very, very keen to hear your perspectives. So what we've seen is private school girls calling out private school boys. We've seen Kate, a private school girl, calling out Porter. Kate's friends, all establishment figures, very publicly defending her. Liberal staff are women, mostly young, criticising the misogyny of the world of politics and the political class. Brittany Higgins, remember, was a Liberal Party staffer, as were other female staffers who called out misogyny in Parliament. And then we have some older Liberal women, Liberal politician women, publicly naming the problem and saying it needs to be addressed. Notably, though, most Liberal women in the Commonwealth government have been silent, even the alleged Minister for Women, Maurice Pine. I mean, that's not my joke. It's Crikey's joke, actually, calling her the alleged Minister for Women. and then we have the ever so silent ruling class Liberal women who might be called bystanders or even enablers. And I can certainly think of some who have internalised misogyny. And Michaela Cash obviously springs to mind. Now, in Morrison's reshuffle, many of these same women are to be spokespeople for all women. Morrison will chair a task force which includes all the women in cabinet to oversee so-called women's issues. I might add the task force also includes Frydenberg, Birmingham, and you'll also all be hugely relieved to know Michael McCormack. Now, Morrison has also created the positions of Minister for Women's Economic Security, Jane Hume, and Minister for Women's Safety, Anne Rustin. Amanda Stoker adds Assistant Minister for Women to her other Assistant Minister roles. And I'm sure you've seen the publicity recently, which hasn't been great with regard to Amanda Stoker. Now, the historians amongst you may have read Anne Summers' book that is now a classic. It's called Damned Whores and God's Police. And this book springs to mind when I look at the current cabinet reshuffle. And I wonder if these liberal women are expected to be current versions of God's police in cabinet. But what about the rest of us? We certainly should acknowledge the vile behaviours that these women have experienced and witnessed as schoolgirls and as women in political circles. And we should certainly push against these vile men and their vile cultures. But a key question is this: what does it mean to have women from these privileged classes taking the lead on these and other so-called gender issues? Interestingly, out of the 9 women in Morrison's task force, 5 went to private schools, and of these, 4 went to girl-only private schools. Many such schools believe that they have been addressing gender issues for some time, but historically and currently, if they do so, they tend to adopt a very liberal feminist lens. This translates into highly individualised gender equality, corporate and neoliberal forms of feminism, not feminism for the 99%, as that really terrific feminist manifesto recently argued. Now, do we really want these women to lead change for women and girls who come from circumstances very different from their own? Working class women, Aboriginal women, refugee and migrant women, women with disabilities, women on welfare, LGBTI people, and so forth. I suggest that these older liberal women in particular, these conservative women, these right-wing women, are not well equipped to address the many issues facing women outside their privileged circles. Their interventions could be at best inappropriate and at worst very damaging. Now, a third consideration with regard to these two events is crisis management. And I suggest that this plays a key role in protecting and perpetuating misogyny in these schools and in corralling views about these schools and their particular products. Different modes of crisis management were employed in these two events, the Porter crisis and the private school crisis. And I'll start with Porter. He mobilised the mantra that is currently called DAVO. I don't know how many of you have heard of it. That's basically deny, attack, reverse victim, and offender. So Porter did a DAVO. He denied the allegation, strenuously denied, as the press keeps saying. And I think there's always a shade of irony when they keep saying that. So he denied strenuously. He attacked the media. And then he claimed he was a victim of trial by media, so he did that reversal. He also did a DAVO Plus, to which he added what I'm calling the CVS approach, which is the cry, vanish, and sue approach. So he cried very convincingly. He vanished on sick leave, and then he sued the ABC and Louise Milligan. Now, we know that suing is a mode of silencing. And I also suspect that he will win his case against the ABC, in part because of the very lax defamation laws which he himself criticised when he was Attorney General. Now, a win will help to legitimise him and also his type. And I suspect Hale School will be very relieved if he has a win, because then it won't have to take down all the celebratory statements as it currently has up about him on various of its documents on its websites and so forth, particularly around his sort of celebrated old boy status. Now, the second approach, which you may also be familiar with, is called the DDD approach. That's more simple. It's called deny, deflect, distract. Deny or dismiss the allegation, deflect the blame, distract attention to something else. So when confronting the PR disaster, boys' schools usually adopt variations of this approach. And when denial is not possible, they will often diminish or play down, and I'll talk a bit about that later. But in this situation, with regard to the testimonials, denial was not possible or wasn't plausible, and it wasn't possible because there was so much evidence out there against the schools. So they had to adopt a preliminary DD strategy, which required them to invoke two further Ds, which I have called the dignified and determined approach. It involved these things: acknowledging the disturbing problem, expressing their feelings, shock, surprise, and deep disappointment, graciously taking advice. In New South Wales, they met with the police and Chanel Contos, and then promising action. And I just want to give you some examples of the way they went about this preliminary DD approach. According to the New South Wales police, a commitment was made to establish a statement of intent to address the issue of sexual violence in New South Wales schools. Some of the key elements that will be considered during this process include consent education, protocols on reporting, and more important, the safety and welfare and well-being of young people. Now, frankly, this determination does seem rather ambivalent to me. So statement of intent, doesn't sound very convincing. Will be considered, doesn't sound very convincing. And then we're going to consider the safety, welfare and well-being of all young people, not women and girls specifically. I now want to go to a recent press report which was called Respect, Consent, Not Negotiable, How WA's Elite Boys' Schools Are Tackling Toxic Masculinity. And I'll just share some of the details from that, showing how, again, they are adopting a dignified and determined approach. In his address to parents on March the 9th, after International Women's Day, Wesley headmaster Ross Barron said, 3,000 courageous and confronting testimonials. It was painful to read. He then went on, the light that has been shone on the issues facing our young people reinforces the importance of instilling protective behaviour, self-worth, and self-dignity in all our students from a young age, as well as developing a strong moral compass that values every individual. Another response was from the head of Christchurch. He invited the principals from St Hilda's, Presbyterian Ladies College, Methodist Ladies College, Iona Presentation College, and Scotch to Christchurch to discuss how they may work together on this problem. Now, three things stand out to me about these responses. First of all, the language that I mentioned earlier is totally missing. So there's nothing about those highly problematic identities, behaviours, cultures and systems that I mentioned earlier. And because these are unnamed, they are certainly unlikely to be addressed in any hard-hitting way. Secondly, is the notion of respect and consent, the notions of respect and consent are easily accommodated within the school's individualistic psychological discourses of self-worth and self-dignity. Again, I ask, is respect and consent all there is? And how I point out how easily that can be absorbed in much less confronting discourses. The third observation is about elite boys' schools and elite girls' schools getting together to address the problem. Now, this is very dignified of the elite girls' schools, given the gender war raging within the privileged classes. So it's very dignified of them to agree to meet these heads of boys' schools. But do the heads of boys' schools expect the heads of girls' schools to educate them? Are they expected to be a form of God's police for the boys' schools? And if this problem is everywhere, why only involve the expensive schools for girls? Does their boys' harassment and rape of girls outside their gilded circles matter less to them? Moving back to the question of crisis management, after the dignified and determined response, the principals then reverted to crisis management as usual. They defended their school and its existing approaches. They deflected blame to lax parents, alcohol-fueled parties and pornography, and then they distracted attention. And I want to offer you a rather beautiful example of Trinity in WA. Now, Trinity put out a statement in a newsletter to parents which said this: students are not permitted to have mullets, rat tails, top knots, mohawks, extra long fringes, or any other non-conventional style. It is without reservation that the college sets clear requirements that ensure health and safety, as well as setting a high standard for personal presentation. And then it got really hard-nosed, and it said, students who don't meet the school's grooming standards will be picked up by their parents and ordered to get a haircut. And I think that's one of the, cutest distractions ever. Now, another approach is generalising the crisis, and that's a common distraction mode. It seeks to ensure that the specifics get lost in the bigger picture. Porter generalised the crisis at his press conference, suggesting that the whole system of law and justice was at stake if a historical rape allegation could ruin a person's career. The private schools were no doubt very relieved when the sexual assault petition testimonies included government schools. And this enabling moment for them allowed them to project the view that this is not just us, It's more widespread, which of course it is. But it also allowed them to protect the view we are no worse than you. Now, in the remainder of the paper, I will suggest that even though these problems certainly are widespread, these misogynist males from expensive private schools are very much worse than the rest of us. This is because their misogyny is also associated with their dominant social class. Their misogyny also is strongly linked to contempt for women and certain others of their own class, and it is also linked to contempt for everyone else outside their own class. And I want to share a little case study with you just to demonstrate some of these points. And I'm starting with some quotes. Spit on a homeless man. Deck a stranger, shit on a train, sack whack a complete random walking past. These are a few of the challenges that some Year 12 boys from Shore School in Sydney set for their peers on Muck-Up Day in 2020. Their peers could also, and I'm quoting here, get with someone below age 15, hook up with a random girl, hook up, fuck one of your teammates' exes with them there, and fuck a chick, which is three 10 or lower, that's the scoring for the ways in which they describe girls. Buck a chick, which is, they don't even say who, they say which, is 3-10 or lower in their score. These boys circulated a document called the Triwizard Shornament. It included 150 such challenges involving other things such as abuse of alcohol and drugs, bodily exposure, degradation, obnoxious public behaviour, and apparently similar documents in that school circulated the year before. Now, we all know that muck-up day is a day when, you know, kids do crazy things and the schools usually put up with things. And schools usually give permission for kids to be a bit outrageous. But one of the questions I ask about these boys is, did they think their school had given them license for such abysmal behaviour? And maybe so, albeit implicitly, as I'll explain. Now, of course, Shaw went into crisis management and damage control, and the DD approach emerged. It dismissed the issues, arguing this is not who we are. It involves a few bad apples and some isolated problems. Then it got very determined and parents were assured that these matters will be addressed. In addition, it was interesting to see the way parents mobilised. They went on the defensive and on the offensive. And one group that was pretty intriguing was called the Proud Shaw Mums. Sorry, hashtag Proud Shaw Mums. And they were very offended that other people were offended by Shaw's few bad apples, none of whom were their sons. Some old boys commented on their negative experiences at school. This is a fairly common pattern. And then, fearing a domino effect, other schools adjusted their policy settings. They always do that after one of these events. Now, always what happens is the media storm dies down and the schools relax. So they relaxed until these recent testimonials. An obvious question is, why do such unsavoury events keep happening in these schools? The school leaders and parents say these boys are unrepresentative of the boys at large, the school and the system. Such denial, such defensive denial, in the face of all the evidence, lacks credibility. And it's much more credible, if you're going to explain these behaviours, to look at the cultures of the school, the cultures of the school system and of the elite class that these schools service. Now, the research is unequivocal on these matters. Such problems are unexceptional in elite schools, and most research points out the particular mode of hegemonic masculinity in such school cultures helps to sustain and produce such behaviours, especially through sport. And you may be interested to talk about sport later because it's a very, very interesting site for this sort of stuff. Now, in these schools, abuse is actually normalised. Bigger and older boys abuse those who are younger and weaker. Straight boys make life miserable for queer boys unless they're good at sport. White boys marginalise non-white boys unless they're good at sport. Boys behave in predatory and insulting ways online and elsewhere towards girls and women, including their female teachers. And there was a good article in The Conversation recently showing what sort of behaviour they subject their female teachers to. And we all know in university colleges, the beat goes on. Private school boys are regularly involved in hazing and sexual assault, and there are any number of reports to demonstrate that this is so. Now, this hegemonic toxic masculinity is strongly linked to their social class, as I've said, and it was interesting to see the way class was shot through the Shornament document and the ways in which superiority and contempt for people who are not us, for example, randoms. And race contempt is also in there. Get with an Asian chick, one of them says. It's also evident in other events that happened at roughly the same time. There was an interview posted on social media. Boys from Shaw were asked to name the worst suburbs in Sydney. Without hesitation, they named Sydney's poorest suburbs and labelled the people in them as druggos, lame thugs and ishays. Other boys posted images of the luxury facilities at Shore. So kids from government schools posted compare and contrast images of their lack of resources in their more poorly resourced schools. Now, to raise questions of social class in these schools touches an incredibly raw nerve. As the headmaster from Shore, previous headmaster from Shore said, these boys are privileged, but it's not their fault. Many schools point to the ways in which they try and challenge these behaviours. They use language such as they are building the virtues they are building. We're building good character. We're helping boys to live honourable lives. That's the International Boys' Schools Coalition, and you could check them out if you want to. They're very interesting. But officially they are taught other rules too, and I'm just going to identify three of what I call their school's rules of entitlement. They're implicitly taught that being a male who belongs to a powerful and privileged class, school and school system confers on them many entitlements. They learn who they are entitled to be, what they are entitled to have and expect. And this sort of sense of rules of entitlement were also evident in this Tri-Wizard document. So rule one, you're entitled to have a privileged relationship to the rules and the law. The document was reported to police, and I don't yet actually know the outcome, but in all likelihood, the boys involved knew that any legal penalties would be minimal at least. They knew that their parents and the school would wield their influence to ensure that this is so. Can you imagine if a similar document from a poor school in Sydney were circulated, what would happen to those kids when they went to the police? The convention is that the rules that apply to others do not apply to boys from these schools. And of course, given that many graduates from such schools go on to occupy positions of power, they also set the rules. Witness our friend Christian. Second rule two, you are entitled to have and hoard luxury. Take the boys bragging about Shore's luxury facilities. Because they serve the wealthy, these schools themselves are wealthy and they have many educational luxuries. But their view is also that underfunded government schools, their problems are irrelevant to them. Their scarcity is not these kids' problem. Hence, conspicuous displays of their own abundance are perfectly legitimate. Third rule, is that you're entitled to assume a place at the top of all the pecking orders that matter, and you're entitled to look down on all of those beneath you. And as the document shows, these boys who developed it look down on those whose bodies, values, feelings, places and spaces do not really matter. Suburbs that don't feed these schools and people outside the private school, the expensive private school sector, are regarded as inferior, as the suburb shaming example illustrates. There's also many hierarchies within the private school sector, as you know, as I'm sure you know, and those at the bottom are less wealthy, less well-connected, less talented, less successful, less ambitious, less attractive, less masculine. And the interesting thing is government schools are not, by and large, considered, unless they are the selective government schools where the most so-called meritorious kids go, and then private school parents will choose that for their kids, partly because they don't have to pay for them. Now, sure, the Shore boys, I'm just skipping a little bit here. I'll just go to the ways in which the quiz thing also had its hierarchies and all the activities were ranked. This particular activity was ranked the highest and you got the most reward for it. And that was what they called the boar hunter. And this was about having sex with an 80 kilogram plus woman. They would award top pecking order points for that. Now, sure, the schools claim they mobilise approaches that challenge these. They have, again, used slogans like "Our schools seek first to build good men." And you might have seen that image down on the highway of the private schools down here. They run events where masculine stereotypes might be challenged. They adopt charity and community service programs and more rarely social justice programs. But nonetheless, all these programs are minimalist and marginal and highly tokenistic within the overall class of the school, within the overall culture of the school. And the deep nexus between gender, class, and race and its links to expensive private schooling is downplayed for or ignored. It's disavowed. So I have no doubt that when these schools mobilise, consent and respect education, it will be similarly tokenistic. And when the noise dies down, it will be back to business as usual, possibly with the exception of the mullets at Trinity, and they might have had to go. Now, the schools rightly claim that these events bring shame on them, and they do. Disgust is palpable everywhere. But if they genuinely wish to prevent such events reoccurring, what must they do? And I ask, can these schools break their own rules of entitlement? Would they even try? Would their clients let them? I think not, and I conclude with my reasons. These schools' main selling points are that they provide ready access to the prized misogyny pipeline that I mentioned. To defy the rules would be to sacrifice the considerable benefits that the pipeline offers the schools, the boys, the families, and the class itself. It is precisely these rules of entitlement that take their boys all the way up the pipeline to the top of all the hierarchies that matter. Such schools exist precisely because they implicitly teach these rules of entitlement. And it is these rules that help the women of their class, that help to keep the women of their class in their place, as well as the rest of us in our place. And I am pleased to see these young women fighting back, but they are not the rest of us. And we are not their main concern. These boys and men's misogyny and contempt are of particular consequence for the rest of us. Their schools produce heavyweights in politics, the professions, business, and the media and sport. These boys go on to make decisions that influence our everyday, every night lives. We all suffer when males with such distorted values occupy positions of power and authority. We thus all have a vested interest in attacking such schools on every possible front. Certainly as taxpayers, we should not be funding their toxic masculinity and male entitlement, their gaslighting, their slut-shaming, their sexual harassment, their sexual abuse and their rape, their toxic culture and rape culture, and their classed and raced patriarchal systems. I'm going to mobilise those two famous words now. I have no respect for these schools, and I certainly do not consent to their existence. Thanks very much.